The topic of my talk is the fine structure constant, and there's a funny anecdote I can tell. Obviously, the person who got famous for measuring solar eclipses, what we just seen, is Arthur Eddington, and he used it to confirm the relativistic deflection of light around the sun. This is what triggered the headline in the New York Times that the lights are all askew in the heavens and made Einstein a celebrity overnight. Arthur Eddington is a bit less famous for predicting the fine structure constant to be 1 over 136. And when it was measured to be closer to 1 over 137, he argued that he had forgotten to add 1 for the time dimension. That gave him the nickname Arthur Adding 1. Okay, with that, we're going to see if the fine structure constant is closer to 136 or 137. The latter will be closer to the truth, and we're measuring it with the fine structure, with atom interferometry. What this is all about is precision measurement, and we heard a lot of awesome things about how precision measurements are important to test the laws of fundamental physics, in particular to search maybe for new ingredients of the standard model in response to the puzzle of dark matter and dark energy. So I'm going to talk about the experiment. Systematic effects are the make or break of a precision measurement, and Ed has given us a marvelous introduction of how to deal with them. You beat them down one by one until you hit a wall where several systematic effects are more or less of the same size, so that progress becomes much harder, and that's the point where you want to publish your result. And then I'll talk a bit about the implications, and I'll show the result. Okay, so what's the fine structure constant? The fine structure constant can be measured by many ways of physics. Not all fundamental constants are created equal. Some of them have dimensions, like the speed of light. The speed of light, knowing the number 299 and so on, doesn't really tell us a lot of interesting things about nature, because the numerical value is different in meters per second, or miles per hour, or furlongs per fortnight. And that means my theoretical colleagues can get away with not knowing the value of the speed of light by just setting them to 1. Okay? So knowing the speed of light in SI units is not teaching you a whole lot of interesting physics. But there are other fundamental constants, like the fine structure constant, which do. For example, the fine structure constant gives you the energy of an electron in the Bohr model. It's 1/2 mec squared alpha squared. That's the Bohr energy. And that would be the binding energy of hydrogen in the nth Bohr orbit. So the fine structure constant squared is the ratio of the electron rest mass and the Bohr energy. It's also the ratio of the velocity of an electron orbiting a proton and the speed of light. It's also the ratio of fine structure relative to the Bohr energy. It's also the ratio of the impedance of free space and the Hall resistance, and so on and so on. It's related to the amplitude of an electron to emit a photon. So this is a fundamental constant that will teach you something about nature and that you cannot set to 1. In fact, the standard model of particle physics and, in fact, quantum field theory relies heavily on the fact that the fine structure constant is roughly 1% and not much larger. That's why perturbation theory works so well. And the way we did calculations would look completely different if the fine structure constant would have a large value. Being important in many fields of physics means that the fine structure constant has been measured with methods from many fields of physics. For example, has been measured by doing spectroscopy on muonium atoms, has been measured by measuring the ratio of the Planck constant and the neutron mass. I will tell you more about that. Has been measured by the quantum Hall effect. That's related to what I just mentioned. Fine structure constant relates the impedance of free space with the Hall resistance. But the most accurate measurements of the fine structure constant are these four, and they are zoomed in here. the most accurate being the measurement of the electron's gyromagnetic anomaly, G minus 2. So that number essentially tells you how strong a magnet a single electron is. It's about 2 Bohr magnetons, but it's a bit more than 2 Bohr magnetons, and the difference from 2 has been measured to an accuracy of 2.4 times 10 to the minus 10 by Jerry Gabriels at Harvard. 10 digits of this number are known. If one believes the standard model, you can extract the fine structure constant from there. Another way of measuring it is using this equation, which you can convert into the fine structure constant. For that, I'll erase the 1 over n squared, and I'll note that this is known as the Rydberg constant, and now being experimentalist, the Rydberg constant is a wave number, so I have to turn it into an energy by multiplying it with h bar c. This I can now solve for alpha squared being the Rydberg constant over c times 2 times h bar over m electron. Okay? The Rydberg constant is the most accurately known fundamental constant to about 12 decimal places, so we'll assume we know that. Then the trick is to know h over m, given that the speed of light has an exact value. Okay? H over m electron is very hard to measure. What we will measure instead is h over the mass of the cesium atom, and the mass of the cesium atom relative to the electron mass is very well known also. So this is the principle of the experiment. We want to measure h over m cesium and then insert those known quantities to get alpha.
How do you measure the Rydberg constant? Because remember, as you said, you measure dimensionless numbers. So how do you measure the Rydberg constant?
By doing height. So, okay, if you want to keep it dimensionless, then what you'd have to do is you'd have to compare this one as a frequency.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is an energy. Now it's a frequency. And this one is a frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So you could measure the ratio of these two frequencies. The problem is this is in the optical, can be measured. This is 511 keV, can be measured only very coarsely with gratings and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, we write it this way. And then we'll measure this one as a frequency, which will turn out to be in the kilohertz range and can be measured. So we're doing one more intermediate step. We measure this one in units of the SI second. And Thomas Udem and colleagues have measured this one in units of the SI second. And then we can cancel the SI second. I'll show you how it works. The nice thing, however, is this is the measurement of H over M rubidium, has so far been the most precise measurement of the fine structure constant that does not rely on heavy-duty quantum electrodynamics as this one. And the comparison of the two is a marvelous test of the standard model. This is a bit how it works. To leading order, the gyromagnetic anomaly is simply given by the fine structure constant. And this can be calculated very easily by my theory friends and a little bit harder for myself. This calculation has been extended to the fifth order in quantum electrodynamics, involving more than 10,000 Feynman diagrams. And at the current experimental accuracy, you have to account for the fact that they are muons and hadrons, and you're not very far away from seeing the influence of the weak interaction to that calculation.
Which one is the leading order error in this theory? Is it the CH term or one of the other terms?
The leading order error, as far as I know, is not the theorist's fault, it's the experimentalist's fault, because there is a hadronic Actually, this graph is old. Here, the fifth order was the largest error bar. That's been fixed by now. Now the largest error bar is the hadronic contribution, I believe.
Okay.
I'm actually not 100%
okay.
Sure. So what makes this so exciting is this is Jerry Gabriels measuring G minus 2. This is an atom interferometer measuring the fine structure constant. this can reach 10 to minus 9 or 10 accuracy. This can reach 10 to minus 9 or 10 accuracy. And the theory connecting them also reaches that accuracy. So we have a unique situation in physics where, so to speak, both the input and the output and the calculation are equally precise. This is not something, as Ed mentioned, you can measure the frequency of an atomic transition soon to 19 digits, but you cannot calculate it from first principles, right? So you very often have situations where one thing in the chain is very accurate, but here all three links are very accurate. So how does this one is updated? Okay, now I can answer Ed's question. I do not know why alpha to the 4 has an error bar. I think it's simply because some of the Feynman diagrams are evaluated numerically, and these are numerical rounding errors. I could be wrong about that. The point being, what's that?
They're all very similar to the point.
Yeah. The point being that the theorists have done their job with the fifth order QED, but so far there's no measurement of alpha and of G minus 2 with an accuracy to resolve this contribution. G minus 2 is good enough, but alpha is not. If we can get the error bar of alpha down here, then we can resolve the fifth order QED. That's the first time this, these 10,000 Feynman diagrams are confronted with experiment, and we will get a better measurement of those other terms also. Okay, another reason to look into that is something that Mina has alluded to in the morning. The puzzle of dark matter means that we are looking for a whole new dark sector of new particles. One of them is the dark photon. As Mina said, it's essentially like a photon. It has a weaker coupling to normal matter as parameterized here, and it has a mass as plotted here. And dark photons that are heavy and strongly coupled are ruled out by collider experiments, essentially creating mesons and looking how they decay. And dark photons that are weakly coupled and light are also ruled out by collider experiments, essentially running your accelerator into a beam dump and looking what comes out on the other side. Dark photons much lighter than this, not plotted here, are ruled out extremely strongly by completely different methods I won't get into. This blue region here is ruled out by the current confrontation of G minus 2 and alpha. So with a better alpha measurement, we'll move this band further down here into the region that is not ruled out by colliders. I should also mention that the G minus 2 of the muon has been measured and found to disagree with the standard model prediction by 3.6 sigma. A dark photon having parameters in this band would explain the discrepancy. It's mostly ruled out. You could make a case that perhaps here it's not completely ruled out. But this is definitely a hint that there might be new physics, unless you argue that this is an artifact. OK, so how to measure that? Here's the principle. How do I measure H over M? I'm doing a very simple experiment. I have an atom in a ground state A. I hit it with a photon. The photon will excite the atom, transferring energy to the inner degrees of freedom of the atom. And the recoil will set the atom in motion. So energy is also transferred to the kinetic energy of the atom. And that energy I'll call the recoil frequency, expressed as a frequency. How large is it? Well, it's the momentum squared over 2m. So it's given by h bar k squared, which is the momentum of the photon squared, over the mass of the atom. If I measure that, I get the ratio h bar over m that I want to know. But we immediately run into trouble. The recoil energy is very small, 2 kilohertz, and we're aiming to measure it to 10 digits. So we need a 0.2 microhertz accuracy. This is far beyond what even the best clocks can do these days, and therefore this doesn't sound all too feasible. If I was able to carry out this measurement directly, I would have measured the transition frequency to parts in 10 to the 22. How do we measure it then? We take great care of canceling the atomic transition frequency right from the start. So this is what separates atom interferometers from clocks. And clocks, I try to read out the atomic transition frequency and suppress everything else. Here I try to read out the effects from the motion of the atom and suppress the transition frequency. This leads to a new optimization. And in fact, all the systematic effects that start bothering clocks right now have been bothering us for a long time, such as gravity, right? Looking for the external degrees of freedom automatically enhances the influence of gravity in these experiments. So how do we do that? We do it with matter wave interferometry. So matter waves, I don't need to introduce them here. So there's a source of matter waves called atoms. There is some sort of grating creating a matter wave beam splitter, meaning my wave is now propagating on two paths, and those paths recombine and then interfere constructively or destructively. The key is that there may be millions and billions of oscillations on each path, while reading out a shift of a fraction of an oscillation is easy. Let me show you how that works. So we use the particles as waves, right? And then we have this matter wave interferometer. In this case, this would be measuring gravity. And just for an illustration, if I take experimentally realized parameters and plot the atom number versus the phase shift between them, it looks like this. So I have to zoom in, and again. And this is data that was measured by Keng Yao Chang at Stanford 15 years ago. So this is not even state of the art. Okay. Of course, in the future, and you'll hear much more about that from Jason and Mark tomorrow, we might be able to zoom out another 1,000 times. And this is the marvelous way in which matter wave interferometry enhances resolution. I can easily see a 10% change in the atom number, but that 10% change in the atom number translates into a part per billion or so change of the phase. Okay. Two things I won't talk about today, but are examples for what you can do with it. We have recently improved our limits on speculative physics that was brought up in the context of dark energy, so-called chameleon and symmetron particles, and you see that it's getting close to completely ruling out these models. There's a gap of a factor of 100 that can be bridged pretty soon. We've also measured a predicted but never before observed force from black body radiation on atoms. The idea simply being that black body radiation causes an AC Stark shift of the atomic ground state, and if there's a gradient, then you get a force. And this force, for a few hundred Kelvin temperature difference, turns out to accelerate the atoms by microns per second squared. So this is when you do your best to enhance the effect. But even if you don't enhance the effect a lot, as Ed said, temperature gradients over your vacuum chamber of, let's call it millikelvin, but probably more like Kelvin if you don't pay attention, are inevitable. And then you get maybe nanometers per second squared accelerations from this. No new physics in here, just a nice demonstration of old physics. Okay. And there are more applications that I won't get into. How do we make this better? The first thing is to come up with an atom interferometer geometry that emphasizes the influence of H over M and rejects other signals. And this is the so-called Ramsey-Bordet interferometer geometry. So an atomic wave packet in free fall under gravity gets hit by a laser. And when the photons hit, you either leave the atom in the same state or you kick the atom, transferring it to another state. At that point, the wave packets start moving apart. So that's what's happening here. We let it fly for a time t. When we fire the laser another two times to send the upper path down. Now we can calculate the phase difference between these two paths, and it's proportional to the kinetic energy of the atom as it flies here, which is proportional to the so-called recall frequency, h bar k squared over 2m, roughly 2 kilohertz in our setup. So we get a phase difference of 8 times the recall frequency times t. What's the number n here? The number n is the number of photons that I use to hit the atoms with. A standard atom interferometer uses one pair of photons, one coming from bottom, one from the top, right? Then the number n is 1. But we use a number n of usually 5. That immediately gives you a 25-fold enhancement of this term. So now we're from single kilohertz to perhaps 80 kilohertz or 100 kilohertz. Unfortunately, gravity also enters the phase here, and this term is actually way larger than the one we want to measure. You could say, well, then let's increase n much more, and this term goes up faster than that term, but unfortunately, that's not feasible. So we have to find a way to cancel the signal from gravity here. And this is done with simultaneous conjugate atom interferometers. So I run this interferometer and then sort of an inverted version of the same thing. And the recall term in these two interferometers has the opposite sign, while the gravity term has the same sign. So I now can cancel out gravity under the assumption that gravity is constant. Of course, it is not, and that will be one of the major systematic effects that I'll talk about later. But the major influence of gravity is now gone, and we've also doubled our signal.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here, let me understand, one path remains unchanged. It's only for each interferometer, only one path gets influenced by the laser, right? So you apply pi over the poles in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And then there is only one path where you, n is n where you have absorbed and you put the...
Right.
And then you only influence that part of the interferometer. The other path remains unchanged throughout. It's like
right.
A spectator.
Right.
Okay.
I like sometimes to call it the twin paradox interferometer because one copy of the wave packet always stays home. That's right. and turns out to be slightly older at the end. Anyway, by 10 to minus whatever seconds. Okay. So we have canceled gravity and doubled our signal. There's another term. Let's get to that later. How do I measure the phase difference? And I use something that Ed has already introduced, ellipse fitting. The problem here is this. In theory, the difference of the two phases is the signal I want. But that doesn't mean I can measure it, because gravity isn't constant. I'm in a lab that's vibrating. People walk by. And that vibration, or the sensitivity of the interferometers, is so high that vibration causes phase noise way larger than 2 pi, and that means the fringes of each interferometer don't look like a sine wave at all anymore. This is actual data. I cannot extract any phase from this. But since the interferometers are simultaneous, those vibrations cancel if I correlate the data of each interferometer with one another, and that plots an ellipse. If that ellipse is a straight line in a degenerate case, then the two phases are the same. If the ellipse is a circle, then it's 90 degrees. So from the shape of the ellipse, I get the phase of the interferometer, and that I can turn into measurements that are independent of those vibrations. Without that, we wouldn't even get a signal.
How much can you cancel from vibrations?
As far as we know completely, meaning that in practical terms, let's say, we have never established by how many dBs we cancel it. I think, Jason, that you or Mark have a paper about how good the cancellation can be.
We can talk about it.
Okay, so...
It's not in dB.
But suffice it to say, the cancellation is so good that we're not at all worried about it, and other noise sources are much larger. Okay, this is the method to kick the atoms with many photons. It's called multiphoton Bragg diffraction, and what it essentially means is I make the atom absorb one photon from here and immediately stimulate it to emit that photon back. Now I have transferred the momentum of two photons. But I can detune these two lasers that after doing the process once, I'm not arriving at an energy level only after doing the process, let's call it 5 times, is energy conservation preserved. And this singles out the 10-photon process over the 8-photon process. Okay. Finally, we have one more method to increase the signal, and that is using a matter wave accelerator here in the middle called Bloch oscillations. So that's a concept borrowed from solid state physics. I have 2 lasers. They create a standing wave, and a standing wave is a periodic potential for the atoms that I'll symbolize with my fingers here. Okay, the atoms like to be trapped in that optical lattice, and if I now adiabatically accelerate the lattice by tuning the laser frequency, the atoms will follow. If I do it right, then the atom follows in a coherent way, so I'm really accelerating the matter wave packets. I'm doing it up and down simultaneously because simultaneity is important to preserve the vibration cancellation. And that increases the signal by a factor, by this factor where big N is the number of Bloch oscillations. And the nice thing is this number can be very high, up to 200 in our experiment. That means we're using 400 photons to kick the upper path up and 400 to kick the other down, for a total momentum transfer of about 800 photons. This number can be much larger than the N from the Bragg diffraction for technical reasons that you're welcome to ask me about. Okay, now we have all the ingredients, and let's look at the experiment. It's a standard atomic fountain. There's a magneto-optical trap trapping the atoms. They are further cooled by optical molasses and something called Raman sideband cooling, which gets them to roughly 300 nanokelvin and about 1 million atoms after all the processing has been done. We select them in the magnetically insensitive state. We select only atoms that have a very narrow velocity distribution. Then we run the interferometer, and then we detect the outputs of the interferometers by their fluorescence. This is the setup in more detail. Maybe one thing I should mention is all light is made by the same laser, a Thai sapphire laser. That means if the laser frequency is fluctuating, the first order fluctuations cancel out. They're common mode to the 2 interferometers. We make sure that the laser beams are co-propagating as much as possible. For example, they are overlapped in a common fiber, which means if the path length of this fiber changes, it's common mode too. That's another strategy to remove noise. This is how it looks like. Then there are some tricks for increased sensitivity. One thing is we learned the hard way that the Earth is turning, and what happens is when we first kick the atoms this way, the wave packets separate along this line. 100 milliseconds later, when we kick the atoms again, the laser beam has turned a bit with the Earth, and so the wave packets miss each other by a small amount, which reduces the contrast, and which we can compensate for by a rotating mirror. We've borrowed an idea from the Kasevich group. There's an AC Stark shift, which is random in the sense there are small intensity fluctuations of the laser, which leads to decoherence. And that can be canceled by overlapping another beam with the opposite detuning, causing the opposite AC Stark shift. And you see the strong improvement in contrast in the comparison of these lines. Now we have everything together, and this is actual data coming out of the experiment. So you see 4 peaks here. These are the 2 outputs of the first interferometer falling past the fluorescence detector. These are the 2 outputs of the second interferometer. The stuff in the middle are atoms that were left behind by the Bloch oscillations. Those atoms are too hot to be loaded in the optical lattice, and they don't contribute to the signal. As we increase the Bloch oscillation number, these peaks move further apart. And since the Bloch oscillations are somewhat lossy, they reduce the signal size. So in practice, we don't work with more than n equals 200 to get a decent signal size. These are ellipses that we plotted. So This is all at n equals 125, and you see the longer the atoms fly, the lower the contrast. So there's a sweet spot for the sensitivity, which is somewhere around here. Okay, now this is a precision measurement. It's very important to avoid what people call intellectual phase lock, namely, you stare at the data until you find that it agrees with your expectations. That's why the precision measurement community has adopted blind analysis. So the way we implemented it, we asked Rana Adhikari at Caltech to write a little piece of MATLAB code that would add a random number to the laser frequency within specified limits. And that makes it impossible for us to actually see what the outcome of our measurement is. Rana is not at Berkeley, and he's not otherwise associated with our project. And after that, this was the result. So that's us. That is Harvard G-2. That's the previous rubidium H over M measurement. And this is all we knew about our result for the past couple of months until recently. So, and now, what's the value of this? Of course, I trust myself to be unbiased, right? But if I screw up and overlook a systematic effect or count it with a wrong sign or whatever, then I might end up here causing big embarrassment, right? So it forces you to check and double check and double check. For example, we wrote two data analysis codes in two different programming languages by two different students and made sure that they yield the same number being fed the same data. And that helped us debug things. So with that in mind, let's look at the most important systematic effects. And it's a big table. And I'll focus on the three largest ones and the three new ones, okay? Fortunately, the large ones aren't new, which means they're well understood, and the new ones aren't large. Okay, so what are the big ones? Obviously, I have to know my laser frequency, and these days that's straightforward thanks to the frequency comb. We have to know the gravity gradient. I told you that we cancel gravity, but the spatial separation between the two interferometers is quite large, and gravity here and here differ on the seventh decimal place. That's not good enough for us, so we have to measure the gravity gradient in situ and subtract it. And this one comes from the fact that a laser beam is not a plane wave, and omega over c is not k. Omega over c is k for a plane wave, but not for a finite-sized laser beam. So that's the so-called Goy phase and wavefront curvature term. New systematic effects include things from speckle, that means the laser intensity is not homogeneous, that causes trouble. Thermal motion of atoms, so the atoms move relative to the laser beam, and that means an atom that's in the middle for the first pulse might no longer be in the middle for a later pulse. That changes the atom-photon interactions. And the non-Gaussian waveform of laser pulses is important to keep in mind because it causes parasitic interferometers. So those things were modeled, Monte Carlo model, taking into account the actual atom motion, and the model was verified by comparing to data. So let's look at, bottom line is those systematic errors sum up to 0.16 parts per billion, including the influence of the electron mass and the cesium mass. Which is kind of a record for this kind of experiment. Okay, the laser frequency is measured with a frequency comb. As a flywheel, we use a Doppler-free spectroscopy so that we don't have to run the frequency comb all the time. And the frequency of that spectroscopy is a function of the laser power that enters it. This is not a very interesting part of physics. The only reason I mention it is we calibrated that. So we have a detector measuring how much power goes there, and we calibrated the frequency of the spectroscopy relative to that power and programmed a little piece of code that tells us what the laser frequency is. And over months and months and months, we have monitored that and came out with a total uncertainty from here of 0.03 parts per billion. The interesting part is that this code calculating the laser frequency is the one that was obfuscated by Rana Adhikari. So it was more than just straightforwardly adding a number. It was the code that converts this measurement into the laser frequency that was obfuscated. Okay, the gravity gradient. I'm sorry. This is supposed to show two atom interferometers, one here and one a bit higher, each measuring gravity. And the difference between the two gravity measurements tells us the gravity gradient. This is the exact equation for the influence of a gravity gradient gamma on the recall measurement. And this is the same equation for the gravity gradiometer here. And as you pull the two interferometers further apart, you see that the signal from the gravity gradient raises as expected. And that measures the gravity gradient to be this value, which is not quite what you expect from a spherical Earth. And we trace that to the fact that we're in a basement room. That's exactly where the gravity gradient from the Earth flips sign. If you're underground, gravity gets stronger as you move higher. If you're above ground, gravity gets weaker as you move higher. We are kind of exactly where the ground is, so we have to measure it, and we don't know.
Is there an optimal basement to be in where you can get rid of this effect?
I guess I should say an optimum would be to be in space very far away from any unknown masses, right? But I should also say that this is not really a large concern for us. The error bar from the gravity gradient is one of the smaller ones. It's just the absolute contribution is large. Okay, and the Guy phase. So a beam that goes through a focus makes half an oscillation more than a plane wave on the same distance, which means your wavelength is a tiny bit smaller there. Sorry, I got that wrong. Wavelength is a tiny bit larger. Larger. Jason nods. Jason knows this. the wavelength is a tiny bit larger. And so we have to correct for that. For that, we need to know exactly how thick the beam is. So we measured the thickness of the beam using knife edge measurements, and you see they show a nice error function. So this is actual data measured by the grad students running a razor blade on a micrometer through the beam. And that tells us how thick the beam is, where the focus is, and what the astigmatism is. And so we can predict the Guy phase. New systematics. And I should say that this experiment started 12 years ago when I started a postdoc at Stanford. And after postdocing for 3 years, I got it to work in the sense it measured data that looks like this. So this is the pulse separation time on an inverted axis. And this is the recoil frequency shift. And you see it's way too large. We're talking 10 to minus 10 as the ultimate goal, but this varies by parts in 10 to 4, right? Actually, this doesn't make sense. Oh, this means it varies by 10,000 of the final error that we want to have. Okay, why is that? It's because Bragg diffraction doesn't have two inputs and two outputs. What do I mean by that? Let's suppose this is a beam splitter. Laser beam goes in, two laser beams come out, right? You have to match the electric fields at the boundary, and the powers in the end have to work out. That means the electric fields squared also have to match. That gives you enough variables to solve exactly for the electric fields that come out of this beam splitter. And you don't need to know anything about the construction of the beam splitter. You know that there's a 90-degree phase shift between the two outputs. This is no longer true as soon as you have a third output, which is the case for Bragg diffraction. So this is something we eventually predicted by numerical code, and the prediction agrees beautifully with the measured data, so we can take it out for subtraction. What we actually do is we measure at several different t's, and that takes care of the diffraction phase. But it's more complicated than that, because even after subtracting the diffraction phase, there's this residual variation here. You see, this point is not quite on the fit. That's from the fact that an atom that maybe starts here a little bit off-center may move to the center for the second pulse and then move to the other side for the final pulse, or vice versa. So atoms don't sample the laser beam at always the same position. And so that's something we again modeled in a Monte Carlo simulation, propagating a few million atoms through the entire system. And then we find optimum parameters. There's an optimum beam intensity where the influence of this atom motion is lowest, and that's where we operate in the end. So the Monte Carlo is not used to apply a correction. The Monte Carlo is used to find the spot that's insensitive. Also, a straightforward experimental way to constrain this atom motion is to just use atoms that are close to the optical axis at the beginning and the end. So that's the spatial filtering business, cutting down the sensitivity to this clipping phase quite a lot. And so this is the final error budget for atom motion. We have an initial cloud radius of 2 millimeters, and that alone contributes 0.02 parts per billion to the error budget. Then there's a velocity contributing 0.03 part per billion to the error budget, and so on. None of these contributions produce a shift. They only produce an uncertainty. Okay, the final, no, I have two more systematics. The last one will be the key. So sometimes atoms get an additional kick or get one kick too few, forming parasitic interferometers. And our model said if you adjust the Bragg pulse duration to 109 microseconds, then you should be at the spot where the parasitic interferometers are maximally suppressed. And that indeed works out. So this has suppressed the parasitic interferometers, again, pushing the error from here to negligible levels. Okay, and this is the key. After taking into account all systematic corrections, subtracting the gravity gradient, taking care of the speckle phase, and so on, taking care of the clipping phase, we expect the fine structure constant to be independent of the time that the atoms fly. But it wasn't so. We saw 30 milliradian phase variations around a constant. And this bothered this experiment for years and years. We've simulated it and simulated again, never found an explanation, until we actually realized something that we could have known right from the start, namely laser beams coming out of a fiber are Gaussian in the middle, but are not Gaussian starting at about one W-naught parameter from the center. Meaning at the point where the intensity dropped to 1 over E squared of the peak intensity, the laser beam stops being Gaussian. And that means if you're far out here, the intensity is way higher than a Gaussian beam would be. And that's why a lot more light scatters at the vacuum chamber wall than we thought. Okay? That light gets reflected and comes back to where the atoms are and causes these errors. So to suppress these errors, we did two things. We got an apodizing filter from Thaw Labs to cut off these tails here and make the beam more Gaussian. That reduced the 30 milliradian anomaly, this one, more than tenfold to 4 milliradian, this one. That's not quite enough to get our error. So this would cause 8 part per billion error in alpha. Suppressing is tenfold is not quite enough. But experimentally, we found, and theoretically it makes sense, that these anomalous phase variations are independent of the number of Bloch oscillations. And so by increasing the signal using more Bloch oscillations, we can suppress it further to negligible levels. Okay, and now this is the latest data of the phase relative to the pulse separation time, and you find that if there are any residuals hidden in there anymore, then they are unresolved. Okay, I should point out that, for example, this point alone, or this point alone, statistically would give you enough precision to measure the fine structure constant. So this is essentially 4 or 5 measurements of the fine structure constant to 0.2 part per billion accuracy in here, just to make sure that there are no unexpected variations. To quantify this, we have assumed that all the variations here would be systematic and not stochastical at all, meaning they don't average out. That would then give you 0.04 parts per billion errors. So now we're satisfied that this has been addressed. Okay. At this point, we ran a bunch of more checks that I won't bother you with. We checked if fine structure constant varies with the number of Bloch oscillations, or whether it's a function of the interferometer contrast, or a function of the pulse intensity, or the way we generate our RF frequencies, and so on. So these are consistency checks that are not part of the error budget, but we ran all the same just to make sure there's no hidden variables here. Okay, in the final 10 minutes or so, I'm going to tell you a little bit about why we do this. And one reason for why we do this is if there are shifts in the fundamental constants alpha and g-2 relative to each other, that could be a hint for new physics, in this case, dark photons. And then I'm going to show you the result. So Bina has beautifully motivated it. We know a lot about dark matter and dark energy, but we haven't found any candidates in our terrestrial detectors. That triggers a lot of work on theory and experiment to find these things. There might be a whole new dark sector of particles that are undiscovered, and one of those particles is the dark photon. I should immediately say that the dark photon I'm going to talk about is not dark matter, because it's too heavy. A dark photon that is very light could be dark matter, but I'm talking about heavier dark photons. Anyway, but that being said, there is a bunch of famous experimental hints for the existence of a dark photon. For example, the muon gyromagnetic anomaly, the proton radius puzzle, even though it might have gone away, as Ed has already mentioned. And so there's a lot of activity looking for dark photons. This is the muon gyromagnetic anomaly. Here are various theoretical predictions, and this is the experiment. It's off by 3 to 4 sigma. That's where it's really uncomfortable. If it was 5 sigma, you would claim to have discovered something new. If you'd have 2 sigma, you would say, well, it's consistent within 2 sigma. At 3 or 4 sigma, you really don't know, right? And so there's a whole collaboration building a new experiment to clear up what's going on. There are dedicated searches for dark photons in all sorts of high-energy colliders, high-intensity colliders, and fixed-target experiments. I'm not going to go into that, but everybody and their aunt is measuring dark photons. All right, so after taking data, starting in December last year and finishing pretty much a month ago or so, the situation looks like this. This is the fine structure constant. These are the individual measurements and their error bars. And then you do a global average and it ends up to be this. The standard statistical tests tell you that this is a reasonable Gaussian distribution. The reduced chi-squared is 1.2. And so you can look what the average is and where it is relative to the previous measurement, and this is the result. So this is us. This is g-2 from Harvard. This is the previous one. It all seems to make sense, and it still makes sense when you zoom in. You'll find that we completely overlap with the previous H over M measurement, and we're consistent within 2 sigma or so with the g-2 measurement. This is pretty much where I had hoped we would end up, because if we'd been here, then I would have a lot of arguing to do. Anyway, but that's it. So what does that mean? First of all, the accuracy is now here. We have an accuracy of 0.2 part per billion, which is competitive and even slightly improved compared to the G minus 2 value. So we can now claim to have made the most precise measurement ever of the fine structure constant. But what's more important is that it's equally accurate than the G, as the G minus 2 measurement. We can now resolve the fifth order QED contribution. And given that the two measurements agree within reasonable statistical precision, that confirms this fifth order QED term. It actually confirms that the entire stuff here checks out. So a lot of physics has to be right in order to make those two numbers agree. 10,000 Feynman diagrams from QED also. That's a significant result in its own right, because the value of alpha deduced from G minus 2 has historically shifted quite a bit back and forth because missing Feynman diagrams were calculated in that calculation. We can plot dark photon exclusion plots. So this is a simplified version of the previous plot. All the high energy experiments are summarized by the bar bar result here, and the fluctuations are taken out. And a new result from the NA64 detector at CERN has been added. This is actually stolen from their PRL paper. And this is the region ruled out by previous electron G minus 2 measurements compared to the previously known alpha. The red band here is where the dark photon would explain the muon anomaly. And our new result is here, at a confidence level of 99.8%. This is the plot we're going to officially show. If I want to brag about it, I would say at 99% confidence, we rule it out all. Why is that? Because our measurement of alpha, going back, our measurement of 1 over alpha is slightly smaller than G minus 2. That means our alpha is slightly larger. That means we expect a slightly larger G minus 2, which means G minus 2 as predicted is now larger than G minus 2 measured, but a dark photon can only shift G minus 2 up. That means for the coincidence that we're on this side and not on that side, our limits on dark photons get a little bit stronger than they would otherwise have been. Anyway, so that's that. I should mention that there are other particles that I've talked that we could mention here. There, the dark photon is a dark vector boson. There might be a dark axial vector. There might be a dark scalar, and so on. Let me close by thanking the tremendous people that have labored on this till the end. I should mention postdoc Richard Parker, who is just spectacular for these types of experiments. If I go into the lab and ask him, have we ever checked the dependence on alpha on the intensity of the last pulse? He says, yes, we did. And after a minute, he has the data. Before that, we never had this kind of bookkeeping, and we would spend 2 more days to remeasure it, right? They have, together with the grad students Wei Cheng and Cheng Wei, have done all the modeling, have worked night and day to take that data, because in the end, you have to collect enough data to beat the statistics, and you just have to keep the machine running before you have to realign it again. I should mention that the machine was realigned 4 times during the data taking, and the 4 different sets of data are statistically in agreement with one another. And yes, this is the result. Thank you very much for your attention. Yeah, let's see. I even have a slide on this. If I find it. So the key here is, the key of this entire experiment is that K is not omega over C, because the laser beam has a finite size. And that means 2 things. First of all, it means that the wavefronts aren't flat, and that means we need to know where the atoms are in order to know how they will be kicked. Right, but we don't know exactly where the atoms are. That error goes down with the square of the beam radius. The second thing is that the intensity is not the same everywhere. So some atoms see the full intensity, some see a reduced intensity causing errors. That error goes down with the beam radius to the fourth power. So increasing the beam radius seems like a good idea. And so our beam radius now is like this. And we want to increase it to that size. That will, of course, make the speckle effect much worse. And so we need a very thick vacuum chamber. And we've been extremely lucky, first of all, that Dave DeMille at Yale built what he calls the Death Star, which is a joule-level pulse laser that generates 100 microsecond pulses. So the average power of this laser will be a few watts, just like the average power of our present laser. But by generating the power only when we need it, we have 1,000 times the power that we have now. So the hope, right? Keep fingers crossed. With that, we think we can make the beam radius 30 times larger, reducing systematics 1,000 times. And the second thing is that we've been lucky to be able to get funding for that, but that's a different story. Yeah, so this is how we hope to make it better. I hear rumors that Jerry Gabriels is working on a better measurement of G-2, so that means there will be a value to compare to.
We were surprised a while ago in our clocks that even though our atoms are far from the walls, patch charges definitely contribute a pretty non-trivial effect. Do you worry about that or see it?
We don't see it. What we have done is obviously measuring the acceleration gradient. So I called it the measurement of the gravity gradient, but it's sensitive to any accelerations, and we haven't seen any problems there. So I guess because we're not really measuring where the energy levels are, we're only measuring how it pulls the atoms around. Right?
And so do you see a lateral forces as well? I mean, the gravity gradient is measuring vertical changes in acceleration.
We wouldn't. So we have a real-time monitor that tells us whether the atoms go straight, and that tells us that sometimes we have to realign things.
Sure.
If we have to realign it, is it because our laser beams moved a little, or is it because a force is pulling on them? We don't know. We just make sure that the net effect is the atoms going up.
Uh-huh. Why is the quantum Hall effect measurement so far off?
It's because of the... Oh, is it off? I actually haven't noticed that. Let's see. I was going to explain why the error bar is so large, and where is it? It's not far off, right? It's within a sigma. So you might ask, why is the sigma so large? And that's because it's extremely hard to measure currents. You have to convert them into a voltage by using a standard resistor, which you have just calibrated in your quantum lab, right? And then you carry it to the other lab, and in the meantime, it drifts. So measuring currents in theory is a well-defined problem, but in experiments, it's full of ground loops and thermal drifts and so on. I don't know if people are working on improving these. I hope they would, because then there would be another measurement in the picture from a completely different field of physics. Okay, thanks a lot.